Belvedere Tower Condominium Association versus American Com. Are you ready to go, counsel? Get over. If you'll just wait one second.
Yes, sir.
You may begin, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Jim Johnson of the firm of Iden Johnson, representing Belvedere Tower. My registration number is 9035. When I represent business clients and they get impatient, I tell them all the things they could have done as precautions and they wouldn't have been sued. They get impatient, and I sometimes joke with them that if lawyers were in charge of business, nobody would get sued, but not much would get done. In this case, I don't think we're at that extreme. This is a case where there was an agreement entered into between American Communications when it was a partnership and a non-existent entity. The signer as owner on this exclusive telecommunication service agreement was a corporate entity which didn't exist and never was incorporated. And then later there was an effort to enforce this agreement against Belvedere Tower Condominium Association, which is an entity in which did come into existence, and Belvedere filed a declaratory judgment action seeking a determination that is not bound by that agreement. There was a hearing, and American Com didn't present any evidence that there were assignments of a valid contractual obligation from an originating owner entity down the line to the current Belvedere Tower Condominium Association. There's just no evidence in the record to show that. Instead, the order that was written by counsel for American Com says it doesn't identify evidence that there were assignments, but it just argues that it would have been a good thing if there had been assignments, and therefore there must have been assignments.
Pardon me. I'd like to see if I can understand the basis for the lawsuit in the first place. As I understand it, there was no claim that there were unpaid charges. Is that correct? The charges that were incurred got paid for. So it's not like there's a quantum merit claim or anything like that. Is that correct?
I don't think there's a quantum merit aspect to this, Your Honor. Certainly the service that's been provided by American Com has been spotty at best, but what we're here on today is...
But it was paid for, so that's not what... there was no counterclaim, for example, back against your client for unpaid charges.
I think there are counterclaims. I don't know that they're for unpaid charges.
Okay.
But there was a 56B certification, and we're here under that certification to determine the propriety of the declaratory judgment that was entered.
And I'm trying to figure out what's driving this bus. So in other words, your client wanted a declaratory judgment that they didn't have to comply with this contract in the future because there were...
Because they're getting bad service. But
an exclusivity provision or something along that line?
Right.
Okay. Right.
Belvedere Tower feels that it is not in the interests of Belvedere Tower or its residents to have to continue to subsist under this contract for the balance of its temporal term. And the argument was made as the cleanest, most direct argument that the contract is not even binding on Belvedere Tower, and that issue was ruled on adversely by Judge Mullins, and we're here now asking the Court of Appeals for relief from that declaratory judgment. If not, then either in the remaining issues that are on hold back in the trial court or by a separate proceeding, I think there's plenty of grounds to say now that American Com has breached the agreement, but we're here on the threshold question of whether the agreement is binding on Belvedere Tower and its residents in the first instance.
I understand. I understand your response. And one other thing, I assume there was no argument made in the trial court that the Homeowners Association or the Condominium Association ratified the contract by any activity. Is that correct?
I think there is an argument by American Com that because it has provided telecommunication services to occupants of the building, that must mean there was a ratification. Belvedere Tower does not agree that there has been a ratification. The fact that American Com may have continued to provide services in the building means that it's holding over on some kind of an arrangement, maybe a sufferance arrangement, but there is nothing in the record to indicate that American Com is providing services under a binding exclusive telecommunication service agreement. The pitch that's made by American Com is what they argued and what they placed in the order that was prepared at the request of Judge Mullins, which he signed, is that Mr. Nazi, who was the mastermind of the developer, either on behalf of Belvedere Tower LLC, which is not the identified owner signatory of this agreement, or on behalf of Belvedere Tower Condominium Association, the actual existing entity now, which they describe as a yet-to-be-formed Colorado corporation. Well, the fact is that the only evidence is that this original agreement was entered into between the American Com partnership entity before it transmuted into the American Com LLC, and that it was an agreement with a non-existent legal entity. There's no evidence of any kind of novation to make a new separate agreement or to make that agreement applicable to an actual legal entity, no chain of assignments from that non-existent entity to the Belvedere Tower LLC or to Belvedere Tower Homeowners Association. This is all a cascade of wishful thinking, things that it would have been good to do, things that if they had been done might have made a difference, but the fact is that these things were not done. This agreement just is not applicable to or binding on Belvedere Tower Condominium Association. There's a lot of citation of the Lookout Mountain case, and the Lookout Mountain case, like the other cases that are briefed and discussed, all deal with imperfect assignments. There's no question that the parties envisioned that there would be an assignment. All of these cases involve assignments in writing, but there were blanks left in the agreement, but the transmittal letter clarify what should have been filled in the blanks or things like that. We're not here today with a situation like that. We're here in the complete absence of any evidence to establish the chain of assignments, either from the original service provider to others, but in the absence of anything to indicate that any actual existing business entity, Belvedere Tower LLC, which was the business entity that the developer actually transferred the real property to, or Belvedere Tower Condominium Association, which is the homeowners association for the townhome complex.
Mr. Johnson, you point out that there's no written assignment in this case, which distinguishes it from the Lookout Mountain case, for instance. Is there a circumstance where an assignment can be valid even if there's no written assignment per se in the agreement?
The Lookout Mountain case says in dictum that it is possible to have an assignment that's not written, Your Honor. And I have two thoughts about that. First of all, I find it very difficult to imagine how in a business context you could have an effective assignment that's not in writing, because it would then always be a swearing contest as to whether there was one, and if so, what it said or didn't say. In this case, it was alleged that there was a written assignment from American Com, the partnership, to American Com, the LLC, but they didn't bring a copy with them to court, so it wasn't offered into evidence. On the owner side of the equation, there just is no evidence of any actual assignments. There's some inference that Mr. Nazi may have intended that there be passage of rights and responsibilities, but inferring that he might have had that intent doesn't mean that he made the assignment. And I think that it is very hard for me to imagine in practice, in practical effect, how there could ever be an effective assignment that was not in writing, unless if all the parties were present, the assignor and the assignee and the party on the other side, who would then have rights and responsibilities as to the assignee, if something was said out loud which manifested the intent, and that was all understood and agreed to, maybe in that setting that could constitute an assignment. Then I still wonder down the line if there were a further assignment by the party on one side who had witnessed the oral assignment, if there's a further assignment on the other side of the letter, how is that S&E going to know that there was a previous assignment if there's nothing in writing? A part of the problem with this notion that there can be secret assignments based on undisclosed intent, that there ought to be an assignment, is that assignments are part of the law of contracts, and that the people who are going to be affected by the assignment have to know about it and have to know that there has been an assignment, what the assignment consists of, and under this contract they have to consent to it. I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
Hold on one question, counsel.
Yes, sir.
You can stop the clock, though. In your opponent's brief, they say, you know, assignment can be inferred from the acts or conduct of the parties. In your opponent's brief, they cite, I believe, three instances of evidence that they believe would support a reasonable inference that there had, in fact, been an acceptance of an assignment by Belvedere. They point to a Mr. McManus acknowledging and accepting the agreement, testifying that he had declared a default under the agreement, which indicates that he thought there may have been an agreement between the parties. They also cite to Belvedere's attorneys claiming the agreement had been repudiated by American Com. And then they also cite, as I think a third or fourth fact, that Belvedere had faithfully paid American Com for years, all of which suggests, or they argue, is sufficient to support a reasonable inference that the assignment had indeed been accepted by Belvedere. What response do you have to that, counsel?
With respect to the ostensible testimony of Mr. McManus, Your Honor, I went back and read that part of the transcript, and Mr. McManus, as far as I could tell, never acknowledged that the exclusive telecommunications service agreement was ever enforceable against Belvedere Tower. It's a fact that American Com has a bunch of equipment in the building and that it provides sporadic telecommunication services to residents in the building. Sometimes they can watch the Bronco game, sometimes they can't. But it's not disputed that AmericanCom has equipment in the building and is providing services, but the question is whether it's doing so under the terms of the exclusive telecommunications service agreement. And I think Mr. McManus's testimony is that the association is not and has never been bound by that. Because of this dispute, it hasn't tried to evict AmericanCom, but I don't think Mr. McManus has ever testified that he deems it to be binding on the association, and I think to the contrary, he's testified that it's not. With respect to repudiation, I think that to the extent that that was a repudiation referring to the telecommunication service agreement, it would have been an argument along the lines that if that agreement were binding on Belvedere Tower, it had abundant grounds to say that the agreement had been breached. And I think that Belvedere Tower can dispute whether the agreement is applicable while also arguing that if it were applicable, there's been a breach by AmericanCom, which should release Belvedere Tower from having to continue to be bound by the agreement. And with respect to AmericanCom having the equipment in the building, as I said, there's no argument that AmericanCom has telecommunication equipment in the building, and that sometimes the people that receive cable TV through AmericanCom can watch TV, sometimes on some channels, often not on all channels, but that begs the question. That tries to skip over the question of whether there was a valid agreement between AmericanCom and a non-existent entity, and then whether there's a chain of assignments that come down to Belvedere Tower Condominium Association. There's no question that under some arrangement, AmericanCom is providing services, but the question is whether it's providing those on sufferance. It has the equipment in the building.
Counsel, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Bruce Rohde, registration number 11465. I represent AmericanCom. I'd first like to address the standard of review here, because I think as the question and answer session that we just heard unfolded, it's important to keep in mind that we're not arguing how evidence ought to be interpreted. We're not arguing whether the evidence here is the same as or even more compelling than that presented in Lookout Mountain or Phoenix Capital or the other what's just been called imperfect assignment cases. We're arguing the sufficiency of the evidence under a clearly erroneous standard. And there's been some suggestion in Belvedere's papers that instead we're operating under a de novo standard because the court improperly looked only for evidence of intent, only for evidence of intent, rather than for evidence of an actual assignment. And first of all, that's simply not true. In two separate places in the opinion, the court finds that Mr. Nassy caused the agreement to be assigned.
What's the evidence that backs up that finding, counsel?
Well, there's evidence of both the assignment and the acceptance of the assignment. First, we have Exhibit 21, which is the letter that Mark Cladney, construction manager, evidence of both actual and apparent authority to act on behalf of the owner, wrote saying that the agreement had been conveyed, not was going to be conveyed, had been conveyed. Then we have the conversation referenced in that letter that took place between Mr. Occhionero, and of which Mr. Occhionero testified, between Mr. Occhionero and representatives of the owner. Then we have the fact that Mr. Nassy certainly had incentive to accomplish the assignment, to avoid the liability of entity development or ownership entities that would continue after the condo, the complex had been conveyed in order to avoid either personal liability or the liability of those entities.
But Mr. Rohde, without the actual assignment itself before the court, how could the court have had sufficient evidence to determine that the assignment took place?
It's what I'm just, the evidence of that I'm just reciting and more. There is no rule of law in Colorado or, to my knowledge, in other jurisdictions that an assignment of this nature cannot be oral. And may, instead, it can be oral. And that's, I think, what one of the teachings of Lookout Mountain is.
Is it your contention that this assignment was oral or that it was in writing?
My contention is that the assignment was accomplished either orally or in writing, as indicated by Exhibit 21. Mr. Nassy's construction manager, Mr. Cladney, did not spell out whether the contract had been conveyed in writing or orally. He simply spelled out that it had been conveyed.
And
that's
what's important. Was there any witness who testified what the terms of the assignment were?
No, ma'am.
Would you agree that Exhibit 21 goes to the intent of the assigner, or do you believe it also goes to the acceptance of the assignee?
I think it goes to both, but not just to intent, but to the fact of the assignment, because it says that the agreement had been conveyed.
And how does it go to the acceptance of the assignee? I guess I'm not seeing that.
Because the fact that we have one party conveying to another is some evidence that that other party, in connection with that conveyance, accepted it. I think the more compelling evidence of the acceptance is that recited by Judge Daly. And that is the fact that, and more. First of all, we have Mr. McManus's memorandum to the homeowners after the dispute arose regarding the temporary shutoff of services and how payment should be made for the services, where Mr. McManus speaks to what American is supposed to be doing by contract. By contract. Second, we have the letter from Mr. Martineau, the association's attorney at the time, claiming that the agreement had been repudiated, rescinded, or canceled. Not that it was void ab initio, not that it had not been properly assigned, but that it had been, but rather that it had been repudiated, canceled, or rescinded.
Can you give me a record cite for those, counsel?
The letter is Exhibit 25. The memo is Exhibit 24. Then, following those complaints, we have the owner's list that was provided to American, consistent with how they agreed to bill under the agreement, billing the owners for their individual services. That is Exhibit 28. And then we have the payment records that show that the homeowners, consistent with the contract, paid American for the services it provided them for many years, and that is Exhibit 29. Then we have Mr. McManus's testimony about claimed defaults under the agreement and disputes regarding whether appropriate notice was given with those defaults. We also have Mr. McManus's testimony that he did, in fact, receive contracts when the complex was turned over to the Homeowners Association. Although he may have conveniently denied that he received delivery of this particular written contract, it's certainly evidence that hard contracts were indeed turned over to, conveyed to, and accepted by the association. And of course, Judge Mullins was perfectly free to question the credibility of Mr. McManus's testimony regarding the transfer and delivery of this particular hard contract.
Pardon me, Mr. Rohde, you mentioned a Mr. McManus document of claimed defaults. Where is that in the record? Approximately, if you can't.
I'm sorry, Judge. I think it's in the latter exhibits or the exchange of correspondence in that regard. I'd like to speak to what I call the no starter argument and point out that, as the court found, only one of three things could have happened here. Either Mr. Nassy intended that Belvedere Tower LLC, the then owner of the complex, be bound by the agreement, and that's supported by the evidence, again, under the clearly erroneous standard. The contract itself contains a representation that he is signing as capital O owner, and Belvedere Tower LLC was indeed the owner. It was in existence. I think the fact that an entity is in existence goes to whether or not an existent versus a non-existent entity is intended to be bound. And Mr. Nassy could, as manager of that existing entity, bind that entity. The second possibility is that he, Mr. Nassy, was thinking that he would form a condo association, and he wanted the condo association to be bound by this agreement, but he was thinking at the time that the condo association would be called Belvedere Tower Homeowners Association, and that it would be an LLC. And instead, as it turned out, the Homeowners Association was formed as a corporation, and it was called Belvedere Tower Condominium Association. Well, in that case, this is precisely the kind of imperfect assignment, a clerical mistake, that makes the case akin to that in Lookout Mountain, where we simply have a mistake regarding the identity of the entity to be formed, but clearly the intent on both parties that an entity, the Homeowners Association, be bound.
Well, but the difference between the Lookout Mountain and the Phoenix versus Dow cases in this one is that in those cases you had some proof that an assignment was attempted, and you had written assignments in both of those cases. How do you square this case with those?
Judge, I can't add to the evidence that I've recited anymore, because I believe that's a pretty complete list of the evidence that supports the fact of the assignment. I think it's sufficient under the clearly erroneous standard. We're looking to see whether there is no evidence in the record to support the fact of an assignment, or whether there is evidence.
Okay.
Not whether it's different, as compelling, as in Lookout Mountain, simply whether it's sufficient.
Let me ask you a different question. Mr. Johnson says that in the trial court, you contended that there had been ratification of the agreement. Where is that contained in the record?
It's found in the trial court's findings on page 3, where in the second to the last full paragraph, where the court finds that Belvedere manifested its intent to be bound by the agreement through the many of the same acts that I just spoke of.
Do you argue ratification on appeal?
No, Your Honor. But we did argue that its conduct evinced its effort to be bound by the agreement, as evidenced by the evidence I've recited.
Did Mr. Nassy was obviously a central player in this case. Did he testify or provide an affidavit?
No, Judge, neither.
Do you know why he wasn't put on to?
He could not be found by us anyway.
Okay, thank you.
The third possibility is that Mr. Nassy didn't make a mistake at all, and that he intended this entity that was never formed to be bound by the agreement and then never formed it. Well, the ruling of Quaker Hill then is that in that case, Mr. Nassy was personally bound by the agreement, because it was certainly not Americans' understanding that it was contracting with a non-existent entity that was never going to be formed, so that there was no one going to be bound, which is the exception to the general rule of Quaker State. Instead, Americans certainly intended someone to be bound. So in either of these three cases, the bottom line is that someone on the owner's side is bound by this agreement, and therefore it could and was assignable. Finally, with respect to the operator side, I'd like Lessett go on said to reiterate that this argument about owner approval of the assignment was not made in the trial court, and under Rule 8 it should have been pled. Just like failure of consideration or any other grounds for avoiding a contract, it was not pled, it was not argued. In this case, the owner, on the owner's side at the time the assignment was accomplished, could very well have been a NASI-controlled entity. So it would have been a non-issue. Even if we infer that the association was on the other side, was the owner at the time approval could have been sought, then we didn't have any opportunity to present any evidence that it was sought or obtained, or that any withholding of approval on the part of the association would have been reasonable. The complaints that are spoken of in Belvedere's papers are not complaints that were made. The complaints that are the subject of Mr. Martineau's letter about rescission and repudiation are not complaints about assignment from American, the partnership to American, the LLC. They're complaints about performance under the contract that could give rise to this alleged repudiation, rescission, or cancellation. Not a complaint, as the court has customarily heard, that perhaps the assignee is not as financially capable of performance, or the restaurant cases that have been cited in the briefs where the assignee intends to run a completely new and different operation so that the withholding of consent to the assignment is reasonable. Instead, very much an issue of fact, whether the assignment, any withholding of approval of the assignment was reasonable, would have been squarely addressed in the trial court had it been raised, but it was not raised. Does the court have any other questions? Well, then I would just close by saying, Judge Terry, as you put it, I really believe that truly what is driving this bus, as you put it, is a breach of contract claim. Curiously, that claim is not pled or raised, but that's really at the heart of this dispute here. Not whether this agreement is void ab initio. That's why we see the absence of any reference to that argument in the lawyer-written correspondence that started this dispute back in September. That's why no complaint was filed for 5 years, 5 years after that dispute originally came about. No, this contract exists. Was validly assigned by both the operator and the owner side, and ought to be upheld, and Judge Mullen's decision affirmed.
With respect to the assignment of rights and obligations between the American Com partnership and the American Com LLC, I can't fathom this effort to shift a burden onto Belvedere Tower, either to plead things that interfere with the efficacy of that assignment or otherwise. The party claiming there's an assignment has the burden of proof to show that there's been an assignment. And this assignment from the partnership to the LLC could not be effective without consent. That's part of American Com's burden, and American Com did not sustain that burden. But this case lives or dies on the question of whether a contract with a non-existent entity could then be secretly assigned with no evidence that there ever was an assignment. And Mr. Rohde calls it the no-starter argument, saying no matter what you assume about what Craig Nazi had in mind, any way you slice it, Mr. Nazi should have wanted to have assignments. I thought about this for a long time in the briefing, Your Honors, and the best thing I could think of was something my father used to say. Maybe Mr. Nazi intended to go to Paris, but proving that he intended to go to Paris doesn't prove that he was in Paris. In the same way, whatever argument there is that Mr. Nasi might have been well advised to have these obligations conveyed to the condominium association, whatever evidence there is that it might have been short-sighted of him not to do that, there has to be proof of an assignment before that that desirability is anything more than a pipe dream.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. Court will be in recess, and the bailiff shall so announce.